My name is Arnie Ohox, and this is the first forum that we are running this week of July 21st. The title of this forum is Divorce and Remarriage. I'd like to welcome you all of you to this forum, first one of this week, and I think hope we will find this a lively topic for discussion. The title, Divorce and Remarriage, what we'd like to do is open up that whole question for you in terms of comments and reflections and feelings and thoughts. The purpose of a forum at Holden Village is to give you more time to dialogue with one another and to share ideas and feelings than can sometimes happen in a normal teaching type session. So we want to give this forum as much time for you as possible. To facilitate the way forums run at Holden, I'll just mention a few ground rules, if you will, that we try to maintain. One is that so we all understand what we're in for, the forums are set for 1 hour, and at 10 o'clock or a couple minutes after now, because we started a little late, I will cut off the forum, and if there's discussion that needs to continue, we'll encourage you to do that among yourselves or with whoever you might want to continue discussing either after the forum or during the day sometime tomorrow. There's a Compline service in here shortly after the forum is scheduled to close, so we will have to honor that. The other points to keep in mind, our forums are designed for free exchange of ideas, disagreement, discussion. There is no consensus that we try to reach. The purpose of a forum is not to convince anyone of an absolute truth of your position or anything like that. It is to be an open exchange of ideas. So that's what we encourage. It works best in conversation and sharing of feelings or perspectives if you keep in mind trying to make I statements, I think or I feel, and that's helpful to identify the fact that you are sharing your opinion, your feeling, and gives other people permission to share theirs. There will be a little bit of an opening to this particular forum. It grew out of some discussion I had with Barb Rossing, village pastor, over the last week or so. So Barb and I are both going to be giving a little bit of input at the beginning. My interest in this particular topic comes from the perspective of the remarriage side, and because I'm going to give the opening kind of information that I'd like to throw out for discussion, we will kind of be backing into the divorce question. But I think you'll find that we will open the whole area up for discussion. Barb will raise a couple perspectives or questions after I'm through that I think will focus us a little more toward the divorce end itself and also some other perspectives on remarriage. The concern that I bring to this particular topic is from a pastoral perspective. This is not so much a scholarship concern or anything like that. It's a pastoral concern. It's one that I've run across in my experience, and I've discovered that in dealing with people who are remarried in the church, for the most part, regardless of the official statements or stands of the church, and I have a copy of the ALC document, which comes across quite affirmative of the possibility of remarriage, what people have heard, in fact, from the church is a message that calls into question whether remarriage is sort of a clean slate relationship or not. Most difficult problem with that has been the statements in Scripture and the Gospels that seem to be so clear and so concise in terms of Jesus saying anyone who divorces his wife and remarries is committing adultery, and puts the spouse in the position of committing adultery as well. We haven't been able to deal with that very adequately, at least in terms of pastoral ministry. I ran across some different perspectives on that than I have had in the past that have been helpful to me. Those are the ones I'd like to quickly share with you as a background to suggesting that perhaps in the church we can do a better job pastorally ministering to one another when remarriage is the situation that we're dealing with. I have been doing some reading recently, and an exciting article to me that I read recently dealt with what was it that Jesus was talking about when he made those very forthright statements concerning divorce and remarriage. And the point of this particular author was mainly that if we look carefully at the history of the divorce question in the Hebrew tradition, and then take a look at the words that are used in the New Testament that Jesus uses when he speaks of divorce, it's really the case that we're dealing with something different from what you and I think of when we talk about divorce, which is our cultural, very legally defined kind of a process of separation. In the Old Testament period, two concepts were apparently operative. The one was a practice which was simply a very cruel practice, but one that was a reality nonetheless, and that was that men had the prerogative of abandoning, putting away, dismissing the person that was their wife, their spouse, pretty much at will. And that being the case, the woman was left without any recourse and with no privilege then of remarriage or going on with her life. The Mosaic law in Deuteronomy that Jesus refers to when he talks about divorce is that very specific one that says if you put away, and this the Hebrew word for that is that technical term for abandonment, if you put her away or abandon your spouse, you have a legal obligation to give her a written notice of divorce. That way she can go on with her life, and there can be a new beginning for her as well. To not do that simply treats the woman as property, and it's like putting away an old coat for the next season, something like that. So that's the reference. And in the Old Testament, there is a word for that, and that's the one that's spoken of in that Deuteronomy code. When Jesus speaks to the Pharisees who question him on that, there are a couple of words in the New Testament. One comes from a technical word that has to do with putting away, letting loose, abandoning kind of idea. The other is a very specific word that refers to the written document of divorce. In every one of the cases that we refer to when Jesus says any man who divorces his wife, the actual word that's being used is the word for putting away, for abandonment. So the proper understanding that, at least in light of what I've been reading, we should take a look as to whether what's being said is not that a man who puts away his wife or who is going, you know, the relationship is broken and is choosing to abandon or leave his wife has to, the man who puts away the wife without the written document does in fact himself commit adultery and forces the woman to commit adultery because it's that written document that permits both parties to go on in a healthy relationship. To me, that's significant because if that's the case, then Jesus is not speaking against divorce. Jesus did not condone divorce. In the same text, we have the quote of what God has joined together, let not man put asunder, separate. So he holds the ideal before the people all the time, but in the context of a broken world where broken relationships are real, he says you have no right to abandon the other person. And if you simply abandon the other person without giving them their freedom in terms of the proper procedure of divorce, then you in fact commit adultery and force the other person to commit adultery. But there's never any implication that when that process is followed, that either party then is engaging in what would come under the category of adultery. Pastorally, to me, that's a freeing thing, because again, I run into people who are in remarriage situations where they believe in their heart it is a good thing and they're experiencing it as a good thing, and yet they still carry with them this deep level of guilt and belief that Jesus says what I'm doing is committing adultery and forcing my wife to commit adultery, and the best I can do is hope to make peace with that. But I can't really ever believe in my heart that there's real freedom for that. Some important implications, I think, for ministry to people in that kind of situation. You may want to pursue some of those those leads in our discussion, and I feel very free to do that. I do want to keep the introductory remarks as limited as possible, but I think my point is that Jesus is not speaking against divorce, if this is an appropriate way to read the text. He's rather speaking against abandonment. And when the Pharisees asked him, why then did Moses, you know, go to the trouble of writing this very specific law, Jesus says, for the hardness of heart. It's only out of a hardness of heart that you can ever abandon another person. And Jesus says, because you've been doing that, you need to be protected by law. I think we have more to say to our people in that kind of relationship that's of a positive nature than has actually been coming across. Barb, you had a couple of dimensions to pursue over against that.
A nice way of saying that Arnie and I were in a big argument this afternoon.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Well, I guess because I don't see, it seemed to me that Arnie was just trying to help people justify or go on with their lives in a way that I wasn't all that comfortable with in terms of remarriage, and sort of skimming over the whole, the pain and brokenness that divorce does bring, and especially when there are children involved, the fact that you cannot just sort of leave the old relationship behind and move on with another one without feelings of guilt, without many feelings, without all many factors that need to be considered, and they're not just ones that can be left behind. I've experienced that in my own life from having dated a couple divorced men with kids who I thought were doing a really responsible job of joint custody, but it does mean that you have to be in communication with an ex-spouse, and it's a very complicated issue. And so it seemed to me that Arnie was being sort of overly simple about how to sort of, if we get rid of this idea that if you're committing adultery against your ex-wife, that then remarriage can just forge on ahead without considering these other factors. The other thing I thought was that we do need to talk about divorce itself and not just about remarriage, because I, at least in my experience, it seemed that the church is far harsher on divorced people than it is on divorced and remarried people. That somehow once you remarry, we tend to think, I think because our culture is very pro-marriage, we tend to, that you've sort of solved the problem of your divorce. Now you've gotten remarried, so you're not a divorced person anymore, and interestingly enough, on income tax forms and other official documents, you then can check the box, married, whereas a divorced person who remains single continues to check divorce. I mean, you don't revert to single after, you know, 3 years, 5 years, whatever. So that there's much more stigma in our society and in the church about being divorced than there is about being remarried. Once you remarry, you sort of kind of solve part of what you've broken by becoming divorced. And I find that in the church, for example, when a seminarian or pastor is divorced, generally it's at that point in their lives that they're asked to leave seminary for at least a quarter or to leave the ordained ministry for a time. But the remarriage, it doesn't bring any of those kinds of disciplinary procedures at all. So I guess Arnie and I disagree over what the issue was. He sees the problem as how to help people who are remarried feel less guilt, whereas I think that it's the divorce people that we should be giving more attention to. So that was all that we were fighting about, which was a big discussion.
Yes?
Well, I'd start out by saying I think you're both right. I mean, I think you're talking about two different issues, and being in the, you know, being in the ministry, I think that helping people get, you know, get to the place that you're talking about is a very important thing. I also agree 100% with you about the fact that divorce is a stigma in remarriage. When I look at my parish, I see the people who are single and divorced as people watching who they're with, but you have a couple that are remarried, and it's like, it's first marriage.
Classic example would be Ronald and Nancy Reagan. I mean, they're divorced people, but we never talk about them as divorced people, really. Sorry.
But we want them to be our God fearing president, and we haven't had one that's real charismatic, so we have to forgive a lot of things that we would forgive Nixon. But and that's another issue. You can tell where I stand about
right.
that. But anyway, but I think really this divorce thing is, I do see them as two different things, because on the one hand, I can see, you know, I can identify with what you're saying 100% in terms of dealing with remarried people. On the other hand, I'm really with you. I'm with you both. I just think you're talking about two different aspects of the same thing.
What other responses are sparked here?
The problem I have with what you said is that it seems out of character for what Jesus was doing. And in the rest of it, he was kind of throwing away all the laws and saying, no, that's not work. Yeah, it seemed like...
Interestingly enough, you certainly may. Please.
The problem was that the male people in the Hebrew culture thought that they were doing the legal thing, that it was proper for them to do it, that they were righteous in doing it. They found reasons for divorcing, and they said Moses backed them up on that. They permitted divorces in previous times, so in the day of Jesus, divorce was highly prevalent, and they were justifying it all. Isn't Jesus saying you can't do that? You're committing adultery when you do that, and you ought to recognize that. You ought to recognize the fact that there is no such thing as a person not being an adulterer. We're all adulterers. And Jesus said elsewhere that we are adulterers in thought as well as in deed. And he wanted them to feel that burden, not be able to say, well, we're law keepers because we get a divorce. That's what they, in effect, as they were saying. Moses permitted it, therefore we are law keepers when we do it. So he had to make them understand that that was... And that was also in defense of the position of the lady, that they should recognize the position of women in the society. So we have to say, come at it the same way. When we're counseling people who want divorce or are going through a divorce, or whether they've been divorced or whether they're leaving, we have to help them to see. There's no way in which you can say, I did the right thing. No, you have to admit that any divorce is a fracture of what was originally intended. But we also ought to be able to see that that can be repaired, and that we can be forgiven for that. It's not the unforgivable sin. And so if we come at it in terms of grace and forgiveness, we can find the answers to this.
Hands, response?
That's basically what I did for myself was say, you know, why do we make adultery so much worse of a sin than others? And it says if you break part of the law, you've broken all the law. And if you've even thought about it, and so that's how I've justified it for myself. Saying, I can be forgiven, there is grace. And, you know, why is this so much worse of a sin than another type of sin?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, this is in the context of infidelity, but I think a lot of divorce now is developing from disillusionment. And I'm wondering if that disillusionment between the couples and just being tired of the arrangement or whatever cliche you want to put. And I wonder how that would be addressed too.
But Jesus would say the same thing. Moses permitted divorce because of the hardness of the heart. That's because you're sinners, because we're imperfect creatures. Because these things do happen, because marriages don't come off, because they are fractured. You know, that's an experience, that's a human experience, because we are what we are, the sinners that we are. So he said, God, Paul says that too, that God wants you to live in peace. He doesn't expect you, if the situation is so bad that it's intolerable for both parties or one party, that they go on forever, you know, that should be evil. That the person should be able to have divorce.
What else has sparked that?
Well, I don't think there's a lot of feeling of self-righteousness around divorce. I think the feeling is failure. I mean, I think that you know, nobody has to remind me that my relationship has failed. I don't need a pastor to sit and say, now you know that you have broken. Yes, my God, I know that. I feel humiliated. you know, that's the feeling I'm struggling with. How do I put together a sense of grace about it? I don't find that I need that. I mean, maybe there are a lot of people that come into the office and say, hey, I'm getting divorced, I'm really righteous. Now, that might have been true for the Hebrews of their day, you know, because they were saying we were obeying the Mosaic law, and I could see that. But I don't think that that's the problem we're struggling with today, but we still have the text that tells us, reminds us that we're just not making.
Lots of people who come in and say, I'm getting this divorce because it's the best thing for everybody, for my wife, and particularly for the children. They use all kinds of rationalizations by which they say they are doing the right thing. And it's not the right thing. You got to start there and say, hey, maybe that's where we'll end up, but you ought to be able to face the fact that this is not the right thing.
Yeah, but I think when people say the right thing, at least the way I'm going through this, so I think when you're saying the right thing, you're saying the right thing in the context of the brokenness you're in the context of the pain you're in. You're not talking about the right thing in terms of righteousness. You're talking about we have an unbearable stuck situation, and this is the right thing given the fact that things are broken down, not the right situation in the fact that I'm a good person. And if you interpret it that, I think you're mishearing the person that comes in. Because I know what that argument of the right thing is. The right thing isn't out of the context that, hey, you know, I'm righteous. The context is that this has become so destructive and it's so full of poison that, you know, in a sense you have to exercise it. And it just doesn't come out of self-righteousness.
I'd like to divert the discussion. The assumption is we know what marriage is. Everybody assumes that. The discussion in the other room tonight, it seems to me, is defined as a permission for intercourse. And the discussion when it's divorce is possessions and kids. Doesn't sound like we even know what it is.
Dr. Ricky.
Help tell us.
Now you have a new reference. It's easy to miss the issue, I think, on this one. The courts in New York are currently struggling with this problem. There are a number of Jewish people who are being divorced in the court, getting a legal divorce. However, for a observant Jewish woman, until her husband gives her what is called, I'm told in Jewish law, a get, G-U-T, she may not remarry. She is disqualified from being a participating member of her faith, and so forth. The husband has it in his power, and his power alone, to release her, to be a faithful member of her community again. The problem in New York currently is that women are going to the civil courts of New York and asking the court to order the husband to do the religious act of giving the wife a get, sort of like ordering me, if I don't have my child baptized, to have my child baptized. And that worries me a lot, separation of church and state. Therefore, I don't want to talk about that anymore. The point I want to make is that I think that's what Jesus was talking about. I think he said when this marriage has collapsed, so that the man and the woman can no longer live together without being mutually destructive, don't leave the woman totally cut adrift from her faith and her community and her possibility of living. It's an unfortunate thing, tragic thing, that the marriage has been terminated, but if it must be that these people are going to live apart from each other in hostility now and can't live together, then at least give her the possibility of reconstructing her life. And I think Jesus was saying that it's a wicked thing for a man to do. Really, I would even go so far as to say sinful. It's a word I do not use lightly. I think it's a sinful thing for a man to destroy another person's life when he has it within his competence to release her so that she can at least struggle to regain some structure again in her life, support herself, remarry if necessary.
Appreciate that. Just to
use one of the comments that this woman here made to try to sharpen what I was at least tossing out for discussion. And I'm curious to see what you do with it, because this is some new thinking for me, and I'm taking Holden at its word, because when I read with Holden's literature on what it is, I was told it was a playground for amateurs. So I'm doing some amateur playing with you. You talked about how you justified some of your experiences over against the statements of Scripture in terms of saying, well, why is adultery any worse than some other sins and this kind of a thing? And I think that's the process that has been gone through in the church, because we haven't left any clear direct understanding. What I'm actually challenging is I'm saying that if it can be read the way I'm suggesting, then remarriage does not have to be adultery, period. And you don't have to feel good about yourself by saying adultery is no worse than. That Jesus is actually giving you freedom to say, remarriage, if I have covered the bases in terms of concern for the other person, so that relationships and people are primary, I am not, in fact, living in adultery myself, and I'm not causing my spouse to either, which is different than saying, well, I know that's true, but it's no worse than other sins. So the challenge I'm throwing out is a little sharper than just the old kind of patterns of rationalization.
But Ernie, why are the people you know so hesitant to, or why try to make it not be sinful? Why can't we say, as she said, it's sinful, but there's forgiveness in Jesus Christ? What's wrong with being a forgiven sinner?
Somebody tackle that. I'm just a moderator.
And not a forgiven sinner?
Not till after the forum. By the way, that's why I wear this shirt.
I've got an answer for this.
This will get me off the hook, regardless of what happens.
I got a quick answer. Institutionally, it doesn't work. Institutionally, in the church, it doesn't work. Ministers, you mentioned all the problems. It hasn't worked for 2,000 years. To say that adultery is just a sin and we're forgiven sinners in Jesus has not worked institutionally in the church. It doesn't work. Our mind somehow will not allow us to do that. As long as we keep that little dark cloud around this thing, we keep in our practice the dark cloud. And that's one of the reasons that we have to rework it, because of the fact that the old ways, for some reason, I don't have the answer as to why, they don't work. You've got seminarians that are out of seminary, and you've got clergy that are out of the parish. And the bishops are saying, we're all forgiven in Jesus Christ. Go take a hike. Okay.
Balcony, we haven't heard from the balcony. Here.
I was just thinking of Tillich's, Paul Tillich's trying to reshape some of the religious words we use for sin. He uses the word estrangement. If you use that word for sin, then divorce certainly qualifies as estrangement from one another. And it seems to me that's what a divorce is. And I don't know what you're talking about when you say we don't know what marriage is, but it seems to me marriage is the opposite of that, of estrangement.
Again, to clarify, what I think Barb was pushing me on is to say, why is it important to make remarriage not a sin? Not divorce itself, but remarriage. And what I'm saying is the reason I'm suggesting that as a possibility is that it seems to be that Jesus did not make it a sin, even though we've read it that way. And that if it is in fact not a sin, we can be pastorally more able to care for people.
And the woman in the back row.
He said much better.
Oh, okay.
I think we're talking about two different things of sin. We're talking about divorce is sin. And then the scripture might be interpreted as saying remarriage is sin. I think it's society, as you pointed out, we still see divorce as sin, but we do not necessarily see remarriage as sin, which is different than some interpretation of the scripture.
An interesting language shift has taken place, and you can maybe think through this a little bit too. All of us are familiar with some of the problems that we have put onto the King James Version of Scripture because it's all, quote, Old English, right? And that goes for the these and the thous and a number of other things. And one of those is the phrase to put away. The King James Version, in the statements that Jesus makes, talks about when a man puts away, a woman putteth away, not even puts away, but putteth away. And we read that and say, oh yeah, that's King James. That's Old English. putteth away in contemporary language means divorce. So even if you're hearing the King James Version, you're hearing divorce even when the words are putteth away. The point is that putteth away does not refer to divorce. Putteth away means, refers to put a thing away. It was when women were, in a sense, literally put away, abandoned. And in the 1611 version, King James Version of the Bible, in the 11 instances that the word is used, King James, bless its heart, used putteth away 10 times, and then to leave us with a little fun, put divorce in the 11th. But it's interesting that no Bible translation after the 1611 King James Version has used put away or putteth away or abandoned. Everyone has chosen to go the route of divorce, and I think that's where we've read a lot of our problems into, because the reference is pretty.
Let me throw out another option. I don't know that the congregations or the parishes are really struggling with sin or not sin. I think maybe it's a boundary question of who belongs and who doesn't. If you are single, unmarried, or if you're divorced single, you don't belong to our family, couple-oriented congregation. And the struggle is, who will we accept and who won't we accept in our congregation that's family-oriented and marriage-oriented?
Comment?
Two comments. My experience tells me that you can be estranged, if I understand the meaning of that word, from someone and still be married to them.
Absolutely. Sure.
And if being divorced is a sin, so is that in my
Absolutely.
Book.
Absolutely.
And my comment to you is there are a lot of us who are trying really hard to be included, and we are finding the places that we are included. And there are people who include us. And people work real hard at that.
Within a church context?
Within the church context. Mm-hmm. I really and truly believe that. Good. 10 years ago, because my daughter was three, they said, a lady said to me, who won't talk to me now, said to me, bring Elizabeth to Sunday school. And it was a congregation I had belonged to for 10 or 11 years, but had had a time apart. And I really think that there were a lot of very caring, wonderful people who took us in and didn't say, oh, well, we'll take her in because she's divorced. No, they just took us in.
Lisa?
It strikes me that at least the experience that's closest in my family and friends who have gone through divorce and close to it at times, it's more like dealing with death than it is a contractual change. And so if you start dealing with sin, if people have almost, I think, a murderer, somebody killed, I mean, the experience, if I can't remember the statistics, I'm sure some of you have them at hand, divorce is one of the major stress events to live through. And given that recognition, I don't know what the impulse on the church's part is in asking a pastor to take time away. I mean, whether it's punitive or health in mind, but that there is something very difficult, terrible, that's either being recognized or going on. And even for the people who have had maybe a long history of estrangement who finally decide to divorce, there is a pain that comes out of memory. As far as this is just, as I'm saying, from experience, not from, I don't have the authority beyond that. I haven't been divorced, that I know. But anyway, I mean, it isn't my experience. So it's hard to say, because people who go through something, it's extremely personal. The other thing, besides the death orientation of it and the stress factor, that makes it exceedingly important and something we deal with and that is not to say it's a greater or lesser sin than anything else. It's something that shows our brokenness and our need for grace. Another thing is children. And I find that that's a very disturbing area because it puts a burden on children often. And I'm not sure that we know how to lift that for them, whether talking about church or people involved or families.
I'd like to throw something out as children. When I was 19 years old, my folks got a divorce. And those people, I would like to have them share in our joys and sorrows and come to these things, but they won't even come if the other one's there. They were 6 inches apart at one, at a funeral, wouldn't even say hello. That's 20 years ago they got divorced. I'm still bitter. I still hold it. It still hurts.
You know, and, Arnie, I guess that's why when you say, provided you have all your bases covered, you can go on. Boy, covering those bases, I mean, that is the whole pain of divorce. It is a death. And that that's what every divorced person struggles with, is how to cover those bases. You can't possibly cover them all the way you'd like to, the way you think you should, but it's the struggle to find how, you know, what to do about children. What is best? Is joint custody best? Is it not? You know, and how to deal justly with the other person. I think it's a great, great struggle, and finding your way takes a really long time. So I guess that, you know, I just think that right there is the whole issue of what it's about, is how to cover the bases, kind of, and that nobody I've known thinks they've done a great job, but that people really struggle to do it.
I appreciate that. I just am unable myself to see why continuing to label remarriage or imply that it's an adulterous relationship helps someone cover their bases. Any more than they would if, you know, if they'd leave, you know, if that stigma wasn't there. I hear you being afraid of work. What I'm saying, if sort of people, if that's right, and if people take that seriously, we're going to make remarriage too easy. So let's keep it hard by making sure there's enough guilt associated with it that people will, you know, not want to jump into fast.
But the reciprocal is there should be an impetus to cover the bases before you go on to a second marriage. And I think that's what is being addressed.
I think that's quite a difficulty with the topic tonight, because in my mind I can't deal with both of these at once. You know, I've been divorced for 16 years and I've worked through, you know, a lot of things. But the issue about remarriage is kind of different than the issue about divorce. You're just going to rely on how you roll that through. I've had a congregation that's been very good. But then I decided maybe it isn't. It's a combination of a congregation that's been good and my personality that doesn't allow a congregation to exclude me. So that if there's a family retreat, even before they changed it to winter retreat, I went on a family retreat with my kids. And that was my family, and I mean, I'm here with 35 people from my church. Well, it was all 21 of us. But a lot of these people have helped me raise my kids. And I think there are probably other divorced people in that church that backed off it. And I sort of come out at it. So
within our congregation, at the same time as we have divorced men and women saying they feel so excluded, they've stopped coming to church because people shun them, we have had divorced people teaching Sunday school, serving on the church council, and being totally accepted. So I think, you know, it is in the eye of the beholder.
But it's hard to work at it.
Just talking about covering all the bases in response to your response to his response to children. I just wanted to toss out a possible alternative. And I don't know your personal situation, but let's talk about covering all the bases and think, well, what if those parents stayed married and the child was constantly confronted with more closely, you know, with more situations like that, of poor communication? Because who's to say that just because they're married, they're going to be communicating any better? So, you're saying about divorce is being careful of covering the options. And I think you have to, I think it's important to look both ways and say, well, maybe covering the options means
getting a divorce, and maybe then we'll be able to communicate better and it'll be easier for them. I'm not speaking up for a divorce.
One of the problems I have with words like covering all the bases is that I can't think of a time in my life, either in a job or in parenting or in a relationship, in which I've covered all the bases in anything. I always feel like I'm on a continuum. I can't ever think of a time in which I've never been Simon Eustace Apicotic, where I've been fully justified or fully a sinner. I've always been a mix of both. And so when I think of a breakup, I think of stages of grief. And I think people who get remarried are people who, for unless they've rebounded, are oftentimes people who have gone through those five stages and have come to the acceptance phase, and they haven't covered all the bases behind, because you slip into depression and anger and denial. And, you know, I was talking to a woman who was remarried just a week ago, and I asked her, well, she's remarried and very happily remarried. And I said, well, you know, looking at that end of it, would you say it was, you learned a lot? She says, no, it was hell, you know, and I wish I hadn't gone through it, and the pain was much, you know, the cost was much too high. You know, she wasn't saying it was great. I think, you know, we're talking about there's some kind of basis there. How would I even know? It's like Luther's question. How do I know that I have done everything I can? Remember his tower question? How do I know I've loved God as much as I can, or I've done everything I can? That's the thing that he flogged himself over. How would I know I've covered all the bases? All I know is that I go through stages. And I know right now, you know, like I said, I'm kind of in the middle of this, but I'm on the end that's being left. And I'm I wouldn't be ready for a relationship right now. But there will come a time, I think, in which I will come out of that, and I will be ready to re-enter. And at that time, I think that it's a psychological thing. It's not a sin guilt thing. It's not a justification thing. And I think we're almost talking the wrong categories. And if someone says, "Well, make sure you cover all your bases," I'd be in the Luther Tower saying, "God, I don't know if I am."
I'd like to know what the bases are. I mean, this is very abstract. Cover all the bases.
Yeah, right. And
what are the bases? And there are some who can think about them and identify them. That we might be able
children
to look at children. I think it's a big base for children. What does it mean to cover that base? And to retain your parenting relationship, even though the personal relationship between husband and wife is broken, it seems that that is a base for kids, you know. that's a base that should be carefully considered, and I don't like the word custody. I mean, that's an ownership word, and we ought to be able to do better than that, and let the base be on. And there are others, and we just say bases, but you know, I'm sure we come up with a bunch of them that we ought to consider. I don't know. Complicated.
Is there a chance to have Elmer talk more about his point? I think he kind of got the whole thing. He made his comment about what is marrying and got the whole thing. It's all idealistic so far.
I think it was beside the point.
I think the point is that a marriage is maybe not what we think it is, and divorce may take place long before it takes place legally.
I guess I personally think that there's a, this may not fly at all, but I think that's a whole different subject. I think in this forum, most of us know what we're talking about when we say marriage, and that is two people who are married in the legal contractual sense. Whether there's estrangement going on in that relationship or not, we're talking about the different dimensions of the break of that, and what, you know, how you view it when the people choose to enter again the marriage relationship. Not talking about the.
No, but the point is.
So you're thinking two people who are married and saying, are they really married?
And. No, I'm saying legally they may be living together and filing an income tax form that checks the marriage box, but they're not married at all. They divorced themselves a long time ago.
Okay.
So they aren't married. I mean, it's just a legal thing we're talking about, not a real thing.
I totally agree with you. There is a psychological marriage which has its life that never ends as long as people are alive. I don't care how many times they are legally divorced and legally remarried. And I think that can be demonstrated. The Census Bureau, in its last report, for example, indicates that of all the people who are married for the first time for each spouse, that 72% of those relationships will exist until one of them dies. On the other hand, of all of the marriage ceremonies that are performed, you see, I'm talking about ceremonies now, not people, of marriage ceremonies performed, almost 50% will end in a legal divorce. Think about what skews the statistics and ask yourself whether the church has to contribute to the inability to escape from the feelings of failure and thought guilt, if you like. It's a terrible thing that we do by heaping that kind of feeling upon people who are trying to reconstruct their life. I wanted to make a confession here. I'm the author of the State of Washington's Act, which terminates marriages. We very carefully distinguish in that act between a dissolution of marriage, the legal relationship, and divorce. Divorce is dealing with the entire person. The law can't do that. The law can only deal with what the law has created, not what the people have created. And so in this state, we don't even have grounds for divorce, as those of you who live here know. If one party says that their legal relationship has been irreconcilably breached or failed, there is no defense, nor can a court refuse to terminate the legal relationship. That's totally the option of the people, because we're talking about a legal status that you get into and a legal status from which you escape. The relationship between those people, that which they have put together in the loving sense of a marriage between them, not in the legal sense, but otherwise, that goes on forever. I mean, whether you want it or what you say about it or not, it does. And I'm not a novice in this field. And it never ends, especially if you have tormented children.